one of you goes out and gets 9 other people, you will win this race.
The final day of campaigning in the U.S. Senate race. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, November 3rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an eye-popping temperature spike in the Gulf of Alaska.
It was as much as almost 5 degrees Fahrenheit warmer at some of the stations than what we have seen on average.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
In September, a federal report on misconduct in the Alaska National Guard was released. And since then, it's been an open question as to why long-running allegations of cronyism, fraud, and the mishandling of sexual assault reporting didn't result in reform sooner. News outlets, including Alaska Public Media, have sued the Parnell administration for access to records that could provide insight into their response. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez has been reporting on this issue, and she joins us here today to talk about what we know and what we don't know at this point. Hello, Alexandra.
Hi, Lori.
Alexandra, the Attorney General released more than 1,000 pages of emails concerning the Alaska National Guard this weekend. Was there anything illuminating in there?
For the most part, not really. Hundreds of pages were totally redacted. A good chunk wasn't germane to the request at all. Some complaints about the National Guard's leadership are included, and those are interesting. Some are signed, some are anonymous, some are reasoned, some are totally vitriolic, and they came in waves and spurts from about 2010 to present day.
Have we learned about how the administration responded to them?
The documents don't tell us a lot of specifics in this regard, especially because they're so heavily redacted. But they do show the Office of the Governor discussing allegations on a regular basis and communicating frequently with whistleblowers. A lot of the emails are to or from Mike Nizek, Governor Parnell's chief of staff. He rarely gives interviews, but I sat down with him for 45 minutes to talk about when the administration started hearing about trouble in the Guard and what it did about it. He outlined the chronology of the response and supplied copies of some of the investigation reports that they tracked through the years, and some that I hadn't seen before. The first contact with an investigating agency was October 2010, which was actually before any National Guard chaplains had made serious contact with the Office of the Governor. Nizek made a visit to the FBI then after two whistleblowers reached out to him with serious allegations about drug smuggling and gun running. He stressed it's pretty serious and unusual for the governor's chief of staff to report a commissioner to the FBI. Obviously, that would have serious implications if the person were found to be in the wrong. But a few weeks later, he was told there wasn't anything to it. In 2012, there was a National Guard Bureau inquiry into sexual assault response that was called by Senator Mark Begich. That came up dry. Then another aide to Parnell, Nancy Dahlstrom, says she again went to the FBI that same year, and again, nothing. In 2013, the U.S. Army Inspector General Agency looked into a complaint that then Adjutant General Thomas Katkus covered up sexual assaults, and they cleared him. There was also a review by the Secretary of the Army, another Army Inspector General review, and a Department of Defense inquiry called by Senator Lisa Murkowski, and none of them found any problems. Nizek described it like chasing ghosts.
Alexandra, did the fact that there were consistent complaints raise any questions about keeping Katkus in a position of leadership, even if the investigations were coming up dry?
I ask that because it seems like at a minimum, the sheer volume and persistence of complaints would indicate that Katkus was a divisive figure and that there was a low level of morale for at least some of the ranks. Nizek said that the administration understood that Katkus was making some changes that not everybody necessarily liked, but that because Katkus kept on getting a, you know, clean bill of health, so to speak, they had to trust him.
Did he have an explanation for why the administration hasn't been more forthcoming with the documents?
So, Lori, one of the interesting things about this whole crisis in confidence in the National Guard's leadership and the governor's response to it is it seems like there's two components. There's the governor's private response. And on the most skeptical end of the spectrum, one could say that they're controlling the release of documents. There's a lot redacted. And there's still a lot that they're holding on to. And on the most trusting end, you take the administration at face value. And without all the information, which we may never get, it's hard to figure out where we fall on that continuum. Then there's the public response to the National Guard's troubles that kind of relate back to the upsetting report that came out back in September. It described all of this awful stuff without naming perpetrators or quantifying the number of victims or the extent of fraud. With all of these open questions, it shouldn't be surprising that the public and the press wanted more answers. And without the administration providing that information, that raises a whole question of why. NYSIG says the reason for that was part logistical and part legal. They'd had a lot of voluminous requests before concerning Senate candidate Dan Sullivan's emails and the Parnell administration's decision not to expand Medicaid, and that there were a lot of privileges that they expected that these documents would fall under, which we're seeing right now with the number of redactions that are included. But if all this information had been released, you know, even just weeks earlier, we might at this point have a clear understanding of just how effectively the administration responded to this.
All right. Thank you so much for that update, Alexandra.
Thank you, Lori.
That was APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reporting in Anchorage. In the final days before the U.S. Senate election, candidates Mark Begich and Dan Sullivan are making their final pitches, aiming to rally their supporters to the polls. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, Dan Sullivan got help from two national figures representing polar opposites of the GOP, Mitt Romney, an establishment Republican, and Senator Ted Cruz, a Tea Party hero.
Cruz traveled with Sullivan around the rail belt. At a rally in the Matsu Valley Sunday, Cruz spoke for about half an hour, including calls to abolish the IRS and end federal regulation of fracking. Cruz told a few hundred cheering fans the race would be won or lost right there.
The men and women in this room, if every one of you goes out and gets 9 other people, you will win this race, you will elect Dan Sullivan, and you personally will retire Harry Reid.
An Anchorage airplane hangar was the scene of a Republican rally with Romney today. Sullivan said he was happy to have the former presidential candidate here.
It feels amazing. Shoulder to shoulder next to him, I said, I voted for Mitt Romney.
By contrast, Begich's final campaign days were more in the trenches. He gathered with supporters in Palmer and Wasilla, then met with a few dozen public employees in Anchorage on Saturday. With his wife dispatched to Bethel and his mom in Barrow, Begich handed out hot chocolate to UAF students today before flying back to Anchorage.
Wherever there's an undecided voter, I will show up.
Polls show Begich is cutting into Sullivan's lead. Or maybe not, depending on which poll you believe. PPP, a firm that polls for Democrats, called voters over the weekend and says Sullivan is just one percentage point ahead of Begich. But a poll last week by New Jersey-based Rasmussen Reports says Sullivan has pulled to his largest lead yet, 5 points. The Division of Elections says as of yesterday, more than 47,000 Alaskans have already cast ballots through early and absentee voting. That's nearly 20% of all ballots cast in Alaska's last midterm election. Spending in the Senate race is now at $57 million, most of it from outside groups. That comes to more than $200 per likely Alaska voter. In Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, teens weigh in on the marijuana initiative.
I have pretty much no say in it right now, the fact that I'm not old enough to vote, but I mean, if I did, I'd have to say yes.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Alaska Premier Dental Group, providing full-service dental care for the entire family with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Service information at smilealaska.com.
Byron Malott has held many positions in his 71 years. He was the CEO of the Permanent Fund, the CEO of Sea Alaska, the president of AFN, and even briefly held the mayor's seat in both Yakutat and Juneau. He also once held the title of Democratic candidate for governor. That position didn't last long. A few weeks after winning the primary, Malott dropped his campaign and joined Bill Walker's unaffiliated ticket as the lieutenant governor candidate. KSKA's Ann Hillman learned more about the candidate for this profile.
Malott's decision to drop his candidacy for governor and join Republican-turned-independent Bill Walker was met with both support and criticism. When announcing the merger, Walker said he and Malott would make decisions together. Malott says some people told him to get that in writing.
And I said, that is just crazy, you know. You have to trust, you have to work together. The offices are constitutionally mandated and their responsibilities are very clear.
Malott says he's ready to fill his role as a senior policy advisor to the governor and as a member of the cabinet, like he did when he was working as the executive director of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation under Tony Knowles. That's where he first worked with Bruce Bothello, then attorney general for the state.
Byron is an incredibly thoughtful person, very analytical, very principled, and he applies those principles to his problem solving.
Bothello says Malott values family, community, and a sense of place, and that he knows how to compromise. But Bothello does admit that when Malott was younger, he was known for passionate, explosive feelings.
That is not, I think, an issue anymore. And that's not to say that Byron will not express himself forcefully when he needs to, but it's not a situation that causes me any pause for concern.
Bothello touts Malott's leadership skills and experience with finance management as evidence of Malott's readiness for the role of lieutenant governor. Malott himself says he would look at the state's budget with a critical eye, though it is the governor's job to set the budget.
Every bit of spending the state does should be on the table for careful analysis, for discussion.
He says that's true of projects that only impact rural Alaska as well.
It's important that, at least for me, if the village of Kwikluk has a bridge project that is hugely important to that village, that it get the same scrutiny and the same level of public policy analysis as the bridge across the inlet.
But Malott says that doesn't mean he would increase taxes to raise money for such projects.
The notion, again, that we can tax our way either to balancing budgets or to prosperity has been shown never to work.
Malott's main role as lieutenant governor, if he wins, will be supervising the Division of Elections. He says he would follow all laws when certifying ballot initiatives, even if he disagrees with them.
It is there in order to give voters a voice where they believe that their voice is not being heard. So it is a very precious tool in our Constitution. But I think it should be very carefully and not often used.
Malott is a Tlingit originally from Yakutat. He's an independent director of Alaska Air Group. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Ballot Initiative 2, which would allow the use, purchase, and sale of recreational marijuana in Alaska for those aged 21 or older, has Alaskans at odds over the legalization of a federally prohibited drug. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, teen use of marijuana is not a rarity in our state, and kids know where to purchase it, whether Prop 2 passes or not.
It's not hard to find mothers who oppose the passage of Proposition 2.
I don't want my kids to be a guinea pig.
That's Karen Compton, mother of two teens, who spoke recently at a No on 2 press event. But middle school and high school kids are already experimenting with marijuana. at a local coffee shop, I spoke with 14-year-old Bridger, last name not used at the request of his mother, who says it's not hard to find weed.
Absolutely. It's very openly spoken of, and lots of kids, they'll even wear, hats with weed on them. No, it's very open.
How young do you think kids start doing marijuana?
Lots of them will say as early as the 11, their parents gave them a blunt or a marijuana.
Bridger explains that a blunt is a badly rolled marijuana cigarette. He is against Proposition 2. He says he won't use the drug, but many people his age do.
They'll say it helps them, but it really does not help them. Anybody who doesn't smoke weed will realize that it doesn't help them. Like, they just deteriorate. Like, it's visual. You can just see it. You know, it deteriorates them.
Prop 2 prohibits those under the age of 21 from using false identification to purchase marijuana, and it allows the retail sale of marijuana and marijuana edibles. If it passes, Karen Compton says it's only a matter of time before the cannabis rolls down her street.
I live in Spinard. You know, where are these retail outlets going to be? They're going to be in Spinard. You know, my kid's going to have to walk down the street past them.
Spinard is the Anchorage neighborhood once notorious for booze, brothels, and life on the edge, although gentrification has come slowly. Now a yoga studio and an organic restaurant stand where a bar and dance hall were 30 years ago. A young man in a black hoodie lounges against a storefront. He's got the stub of a cigarette still smoking in his fingers. He's the first teen I spot, so I stop and ask him.
I have pretty much no say in it right now. It's the fact that I'm not old enough to vote. But, I mean, if I did, I'd have to say yes on it. Just the fact that, I mean, there's so many medicinal uses for it. But people that just go out to use it recreationally, I don't think it should be legal like that. So.
Have you ever used it recreationally?
No, ma'am.
Okay, do you know people who do?
Yes, ma'am.
Is it easy to get?
It is.
The teen didn't want to give his name. On a Sunday evening, two volunteers man the phones at the Yes, Yes, Yes campaign office in Anchorage. Campaign manager Nick Moe says his group targets the 18 to 24 demographic and is working to get out the Yes on 2 vote.
I think it's easier for a 16-year-old to get a joint than it is to get a six-pack right now. If we bring it out of the shadows into the regulatory phase, like alcohol is, I think it'll be a lot more difficult for children to get access to marijuana if they have to show their IDs and you have to be at least 21 years old.
The Vote No on 2 campaign has raised just under $150,000, all from Alaska donors. The Yes on 2 campaign has been funded primarily by the Washington, D.C.-based Marijuana Policy Project and by the New York-based Drug Policy Alliance. The two lobbying groups have donated close to $900,000 to the Yes on 2 campaign. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. And by Raven Alaska, navigating Alaska's challenging terrain, serving more than 100 communities statewide. Details at raven.com. Raven Alaska, soaring above.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
Over the weekend, the Coast Guard responded to a grounded fuel barge near Kodiak. Coast Guard personnel at Sector Anchorage sent a C-130 Hercules airplane and the Cutter Spar to respond to the incident early Saturday morning. The nearly 400-foot fuel barge had managed to refloat itself shortly after getting stuck. A Coast Guard official says dive inspections haven't revealed any damage to the hull or signs of leaked contaminants. The barge was carrying 2.2 million gallons of aircraft fuel to the Coast Guard's air station on Kodiak. The State Department has outlined the nation's top priorities as the U.S. prepares to chair the International Arctic Council in April. Retired Coast Guard Admiral Robert Papp expanded on the three major themes at the recent Arctic Circle meeting in Iceland, covering climate change and Arctic Ocean issues. But as KNOM's Matthew Smith reports, some Alaska Native groups and state lawmakers say the goals are lacking.
In Yellowknife, Canada, late last month, members of the Department of State gave a presentation close to the media but directed at the five nations on the Arctic Council, as well as several observer nations, outlining the federal government's three key thematic areas for the country's three-year term as chair of the Arctic Council. Robert Papp, who retired as Admiral of the Coast Guard in May and has since been appointed by U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry as the nation's special representative for the Arctic, discussed some of those themes at the Arctic Circle meeting in Iceland last week, including a focus on climate change.
Reducing black carbon emissions and methane emissions are worthy goals that we need to work on with the international community to achieve. And I see this as a particular area in which our Arctic Council observer nations can become involved and assist in some of those forward-leaning and actionable outcomes.
Papp says stewardship of the Arctic Ocean, including better preparation for a maritime disaster or oil spill, will also be a big part of the U.S. focus.
We need to be working together, just not coming to agreements on search and rescue and oil prevention, but implementing actionable items and practicing together and learning from each other, so that we can assist each other when those emergencies inevitably occur.
Beyond climate change and Arctic Ocean issues, the U.S. chair is also focusing on improving the, quote, economic and living conditions of Arctic residents. But for groups like the Inuit Circumpolar Council, or ICC, an international body representing more than 150,000 Inuit peoples across the world, the United States' priorities lack a focus on the rights of the North's First Peoples.
Very clear for quite some time that when it comes to Indigenous rights, both the U.S. and the state of Alaska have been very hesitant to open up that discussion.
Jim Stotz is the president of ICC Alaska. He says the U.S. goals aren't a surprise. He stresses that the ICC agrees that they are all important. But Stotz says issues like self-determination for Native peoples, as well as hunting and fishing rights, are noticeably absent.
Promoting for some time to have a project at the Arctic Council that would look at food security from the perspective of the Arctic's indigenous peoples, in particular the safety of the food, the access to the food, and the health of the environment. As of yet, it hasn't been really addressed, but the food security is one that I wish would have been addressed.
He says those conversations will continue on the local and national level, if not at the International Arctic Council. But the state's own Arctic Policy Commission has also criticized the national priorities. Last month, Anchorage Senator Lesel McGuire and Bethel Representative Bob Herron wrote an open letter to Papp and others involved with the council, saying national priorities must do more to emphasize job creation in rural Arctic communities, an imperative the state's top Arctic commissioners say has been lost with the Fed's more general economic focus. The State Commission is now pushing to create an advisory committee from Alaska, made up of local government and Alaska Native representatives, to ensure that the 3 years that the U.S. will spend as the chair of the Arctic Council reflects the priorities of America's only state in the Arctic. In Nome, I'm Matthew Smith.
Scientists say temperatures in the Gulf of Alaska recently spiked over a very short time span. The warmer temperatures are a byproduct of mild winter weather and could have serious consequences for marine life. KBBI's Quinton Chandler reports the latest temperature information comes from a monitoring program that has collected data from the Gulf waters for the past 17 years.
The Seward Line is a collection of monitoring stations that extend from the mouth of Resurrection Bay into the Gulf of Alaska, ending near the outer edge of Alaska's continental shelf. Professor Russell Hopcroft with the University of Alaska Fairbanks is part of a program that surveys portions of the Gulf marked by those stations. Earlier this year, his team cruised the ocean to take notes on ocean temperatures, chemistry, and also to collect samples of plankton.
In September, we found that the water temperature was way outside the envelope that we're used to seeing for water temperatures, that it was as much as almost 5 degrees Fahrenheit warmer at some of the stations than what we have seen on average.
Hopcroft calls the difference huge. In the wake of summer, ocean temperatures are supposed to fall. Heat trapped by the water rises into the colder atmosphere, and stormy weather also mixes the warmer top layers of ocean with the colder depths. But that's not what happened last winter, and according to Nate Mantua with the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, patches of the Gulf farther offshore saw similar warming as far back as early 2013.
And that was due to the same weather pattern that started the intense drought in California, a persistent area of high pressure in the Gulf of Alaska that basically kept storms from moving across that part of the ocean and coming into the Pacific coast.
Mantua adds NOAA saw the same high pressure system in the Gulf near the end of 2013, and again, there were fewer big winter storms. Seamen might call less bad weather a blessing, but a look at the big picture shows it's really not so good. There are key nutrients in the deep ocean that Hopcroft says sort of jumpstart this giant food web.
So we're used to the storms basically mixing the fertilizer into the cold ocean. And then as spring starts, the heat from the sun starts to warm up the surface of the ocean and makes it float on the colder water underneath.
That fertilizer is the first strand in the ocean's beautifully complex feeding system.
So if you can't resupply the nutrients, you cut off the production of plankton. And then that has this kind of cascading effect through the food web.
Mantua explains if there is less food for fish, crustaceans, and all the other animals, they will spend more energy than usual trying to find food. Energy they'll be hard-pressed to make up if there's a shortage.
And we know that for some things, like young salmon in the ocean, the growth rates that they experience early in their marine life is related to how well they survive to adulthood. Chances are you would see reduced growth and survival for some of these species that usually make a really good living in the Gulf of Alaska.
Mantua and Hopcroft both say Alaskans should brace for bad news. But nothing is certain. There is still a chance next year's fish populations in the Gulf will turn out more or less normal. Hopcroft says right now his team needs time to study what they found.
The Alaska Marine Science Symposium would be in January, and we should have some preliminary information on the biological response to the temperatures we measured this year by then.
But they won't have a real understanding of the impact to animals until this summer, when fisheries are back in full swing. And for some species, clear results may not come for a few years. The scientists are even less sure about the meaning behind the rapid surge in Gulf temperatures. Hopcroft says all they can do is keep collecting information year after year.
We know that the oceans are inherently variable. It's by having a record of what's normal that we get an idea of how extreme those events are.
After two winters without those strong storm surges, it looks like nature is correcting itself. Mantua says about a month ago, stormy weather came back to the Gulf, and it is dutifully bringing the temperatures of offshore waters back down near their regular average. In Homer, I'm Quentin Chandler.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Alan Lockyer in Palmer, Matthew Smith in Nome, and Quentin Chandler in Homer. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez and Liz Ruskin reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Ready to quit smoking, using e-cigarettes or other tobacco? Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free, confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online, and now introducing Text to Quit. Text to Quit helps you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program. Salmon are all around us. They're in our rivers and our freezers. They fuel our economies and keep Alaskans connected to our traditions, our families, and our friends. The Salmon Project celebrates all the ways salmon are interwoven with our Alaskan lives. Learn more about the project and find out how you can be involved at salmonproject.org or find them on Facebook. Salmon, it runs deep in all Alaskans. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.